She had hoped for something wild and beautiful, something to bring the moon crashing out of the sky and to make choirs of angels sing. It had been quick, painful, and messy, and neither she nor the Count had spoken to each other on the winding road down to Nice, except to mutter goodbye on the pavement outside the Negresco Hotel. She had not seen him again. Why she thought of this now, she could not understand, and she thrust the memory aside without effort. It was replaced almost instantly with a picture of a tall young man in a handsome uniform, of a cool, mocking smile and calm, penetrating gaze. Immediately she was aware of the warmth and glow in her lower belly again, and this time she did not attempt to fly from it, but continued leaning on the bridge, smiling at her darkening image in the water. "You look like a smug old pussycat," she whispered, and chuckled softly. Sean Courtney rode like a boar, with long stirrups, sitting well back in the saddle, with legs thrust in a straight line in front of him, and the reins held loosely in his left hand, the black quirt of hippo hide dangling from its thong on his wrist, so that the point touched the ground. His favourite mount was a big raw-boned stallion of almost 18 hands, with a white blaze and an ugly, unpredictable nature that only the general could fathom. But even he had to use the occasional light cut with the quirt to remind the beast of his social obligations. Mark had an English seat, or, as the general put it, rode like a monkey on a broomstick. And he added darkly, "After only 100 miles or so perched up like that, your backside will be so hot you could cook your dinner on it. We rode 1,000 miles in 2 weeks when we were chasing General Leroux." They rode almost daily together, when even the huge rooms of Emoyeni became confining, and the general started to fret at the caging of his big body. Then he would shout for the horses. There were thousands of acres of open ground still backing the big urban estates, and then beyond that there were hundreds of miles of red dirt roads crisscrossing the sugarcane fields. As they rode, the day's work was continued, with only the occasional interruption for a half mile of hard galloping to charge the blood. And then the general would rein in again, and they would amble on over the gently undulating hills, knee to knee. Mark carried a small leather-bound notebook in his inside pocket to make notes of what he must write up on their return, but most of it he carried in his head. The week before the departure to Cape Town had been filled with the implementation of details and of broad policies. The winding up of the domestic business of the Provincial Legislative Council before beginning on the national business of Parliament. And deep in this discussion, their daily ride had carried them further than they had ridden together before. When at last the general reined in, they had reached the crest of a hill, and the view before them spread down to the sea and away to the far silhouette of the great whale-backed mountain above Durban Harbour. Directly below them, a fresh scar had been torn in the earth, like a bold knife stroke through the green carpet of vegetation into the red fleshy earth. The steel tracks of the permanent way had reached this far. And as they sat the fidgeting horses, the loco came huffing up to the railhead, pushing the track carrier ahead of it under its heavy load of steel. Neither of them spoke as the tracks were dumped with a faint clattering roar, and the tiny ant-like figures of the track-laying gang swarmed over them, manhandling them onto the orderly parallel rows of timber sleepers. The tap of the swinging hammers began then, a quick rhythmic beat as the fish plates were spiked into place. "A mile a day," said Sean softly, and Mark saw from his expression that he was thinking once again of another railroad far to the north, and all that it betokened. Cecil Rhodes dreamed of a railway from Cairo to Cape Town, and I believed once that it was a grand dream. He shook his beard heavily. "God knows, perhaps we were both wrong." He turned the stallion's head away, and they walked back down the hill in silence, except for the jingle of harness and the clip of hooves. They were both thinking of Dirk Courtney, but it was another 10 minutes before Sean spoke. "Do you know the Bubezi Valley beyond Chagas Gate?"
"Yes," said Mark.
"Tell me," Sean ordered, and then went on. "It's 50 years since I was last there. During the war with the old Zulu king Cetshwayo, we chased the remains of his impis up there and hunted them along the river. I was there only a few months ago, just before I came to you." Sean turned in the saddle, and his black brows came together sharply.
"What were you doing there?"
he demanded harshly. For an instant, Mark was about to blurt out all his suspicions of Dirk Courtney, of the fate that had overtaken the old man, of his pilgrimage to find the grave and to fathom the mystery beyond Charker's Gate. Something warned him that to do so would be to alienate Sean Courtney completely. He knew enough about him now to realise that although he might accuse and even reject his own son, he would not listen to nor tolerate those accusations from someone outside the family, particularly if those accusations were without substance or proof. Mark put the temptation aside, and instead he explained quietly,
"My grandfather and I were there often when I was a child. I needed to go back for the silence and the beauty, for the peace."
"Yes," the general understood immediately. "What's the game like there now?"
"Thin," Mark answered.
"It's been shot out, trapped and hunted.
It's thin and very wild."
"Buffalo?"
"Yes, there are some in the swamps. I think they graze out into the bush in the night, but I never saw them."
"In 1901, old Seluse wrote that the Cape buffalo was extinct. That was after the Rinderpest plague. My God, Mark, when I was your age, there were herds of 10,000 and 20,000 together. The plains along the Limpopo were black with them."
And he began to reminisce again. It might have been boring, an old man's musty memories, but he told it so vividly that Mark was carried along, fascinated by the tales of a land where a man could ride with his wagons for 6 months without meeting another white man.
It was with a sick little slide of regret, of something irretrievably lost, that he heard the general say,
"It's all gone now. The railway line is right through to the Copper Belt in northern Rhodesia. Rhodes's column has taken up the land between the Zambezi and the Limpopo. Where I camped and hunted, there are towns and mines, and they are ploughing up the old elephant grounds." He shook his head again. "We thought it would never end, and now it's almost gone."
He was silent and sad again for a while.
"My grandchildren may never see an elephant or hear the roar of a lion."
"My grandfather said that when Africa lost its game, he would go back and live in old London town."
"Yeah, well, that's how I feel," Sean agreed.
"It's strange, but perhaps Dirk has done something of great value for Africa and for mankind."
The name seemed to choke in his throat, as though it was an effort to enunciate it, and Mark was silent, respecting that effort.
"He has made me think of all this as never before. One of the things that we are going to do during the session of Parliament, Mark, is to make sure that the sanctuary in the Bubezi Valley is ratified, and we are going to get funds to administer it properly to make sure that nobody, nobody ever turns it into sugarcane or cotton field or floods it beneath the waters of a dam." As he spoke, Mark listened with a soaring sense of destiny and commitment. It was as though he had waited all his life to hear these words. The general went on, working out what was needed in money and men, deciding where he would lobby for support, which others in the cabinet could be relied on, the form which the legislation must take. And Mark made a note of each point as it came up, his pencil hurrying to keep pace with the general's random and eclectic thoughts. Suddenly, in full intellectual flight, the general broke off and laughed aloud. "Ah, it's true, you know, Mark. There is nobody so virtuous as a reformed whore." "We were the great robber barons, Rhodes and Robertson, Bailey and Barnardo, Duff Charleywood and Sean Courtney. We seized the land and then ripped the gold out of the earth. We hunted where we pleased and burned the finest timber for our campfires. Every man with a rifle in his hand and shoes on his feet was a king, prepared to fight anybody, Boer, Briton or Zulu, for the right of plunder."
He shook his head and groped in his pockets before he found his cigars. He laughed no longer, but frowned as he lit the cigar. The big stallion seemed to sense his mood, and he crabbed and bucked awkwardly. Sean rode him easily and quirted him lightly across the flank.
"Oh, behave yourself," he growled.
And then when he quieted, Sean went on.
"The day that I met my first wife, only 32 years ago, I hunted with her father and her brother.
We rode down a herd of elephant, and between the three of us we shot and killed 43 of them. We cut out the tusks and left the carcasses lying. That is over 160 tons of flesh.
Again he shook his head.
Only now am I coming to realize the enormity of what we did. And there were other things. During the Zulu Wars, during the war with Kruger, during Bombata's rebellion in 1906. The things I don't even like to remember. And now perhaps it's too late to make amends. Perhaps also it's just the way of growing old that a man regrets the passing of the old ways. He initiates change, and when he's young, and then mourns that change when he grows old.
Mark was silent, not daring to say a word that might break the mood. He knew that what he was hearing was so important that he could then only guess at the depths of it.
"We must try, Mark. We must try."
"Yes, sir, we will," Mark agreed, and something in his tone made the general glance across at him, mildly surprised.
"This really means something to you?"
He nodded, confirming his statement.
"Yes, yeah, I can see that. Strange, a young fellow like you. When I was your age, all I ever thought about was a quick sovereign and a likely piece of..."
He caught himself before he finished, and coughed to clear his throat.
"Well, sir, you must remember that I had my full share of destruction at an earlier age than you did. The greatest destruction the world has ever known."
The general's face darkened as he remembered what they had shared together in France.
"When you've seen how easy it is to tear down, it makes the preservation seem worthwhile,"
Mark chuckled ruefully.
"Oh, perhaps I was born too late."
"No," said the general softly. "I think you were born just in time."
And he might have gone on, but high and clear on the heat-hushed air came the musical cry of a girl's voice, and instantly the general's head went up and his expression lightened. Storm Courtney came at the gallop. She rode with the same light, lithe grace which marked all she did. She rode astride, and she wore knee-high boots with baggy gaucho pants tucked into the tops, a hand-embroidered waistcoat in vivid colours over a shirt of white satin with wide sleeves and a black wide-brimmed vaquero hat hung on her back from a thong around her throat. She reined in beside her father, laughing and flushed, tossing the hair out of her face and leaning out of the saddle to kiss him, not even glancing at Mark, and he touched his reins and dropped back tactfully.
"We've been looking for you all over, Pater," she cried. "We went as far as the river. What made you come this way?"
Coming up more sedately behind Storm on a bay mare was the blonde girl whom Mark remembered from that fateful day at the tennis courts. She was more conventionally dressed than Storm, in dove-grey riding breeches and tailored jacket, and the wind ruffled the pale silken gold of her cropped hair. While she made her greetings to the general, her eyes kept swivelling in Mark's direction, and he searched for her name and remembered she had been called Irene, and realized she must be the girl who had been Storm's companion on the Grand Continental Tour, a pretty, bright little thing with a gay, brittle style and calculating eyes.
"Good afternoon, Miss Lachaise."
"Oh, la!" She smiled archly at him now. "Have we met?"
Somehow her mare was kneed away from the leading pair and dropped back beside Mark's mount.
"Briefly, yes, we have," Mark admitted.
And suddenly the china blue eyes flew wide, and the girl covered her mouth with a gloved hand.
You're the one. Oh!"
And she squealed softly with delight,
and mimicked him. "Just as soon as you say please."
Storm Courtney had not looked around, and she was paying exaggerated attention to her father. But Mark watched her small, perfect ears turn pink. She tossed her head again, but this time with an aggressive, angry motion.
"I think we might forget that," Mark murmured.
"Forget it," chirped Irene. "I'll never forget it. It was absolutely classic."
She leaned over and placed a bold hand on Mark's forearm. At that moment, Storm could contain herself no longer. She swiveled in the saddle and was about to speak to Irene when she saw the hand on Mark's arm. For a moment, Storm's expression was ferocious, and the dark blue eyes snapped with an electric sparkle. Irene held her gaze undaunted, making her own paler blue eyes wide and artless, and deliberately, challengingly, she let her hand linger, squeezing lightly on Mark's sleeve.